Hey, welcome back to E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and ISBA. I'm Nathan Resnick.
And I'm Aaron Allpeter.
Welcome back to this episode. Today, we're diving into Blenders Eyewear, which is, I think, one of the most fascinating eyewear brands and stories in the e-commerce world. I mean, you know, they're still growing like crazy. A lot of people probably saw the huge deal they had with Coach Prime that we'll dive into as well. But Blenders Eyewear is just an amazing e-commerce story. But Aaron, before we get into that, what did you see the past week or 2 weeks that caught your eye in the e-commerce world?
I've been having a lot of conversations with folks about ShipBob's planned IPO. And really the headline there is that they're looking for a $4 billion valuation. And nobody would be more happy than maybe the founders or the equity owners of ShipBob if they went public at $4 billion than I would. But I'm just struggling to see that valuation making sense. And there's just a lot of different aspects of it. I mean, 3PLs are a notoriously difficult kind of lower margin business to be working with. I think there is a path for them to, you know, get to the $4 billion if they do some different things. But I just think it's going to be a difficult thing to pull off at that valuation in 2024.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think too, like when it comes to 3PL fulfillment, you know, though some people say it's a commodity, a lot of these fulfillment companies actually price in a very different manner, right? Like ShipBob, for example, I think just gives you one price that includes your warehousing and pick and pack fee, and sometimes even your shipping fee, kind of blends their margin into that. Whereas like a company like, you know, ASAP Warehouse or ShipMonk or, you know, whatever it may be, usually kind of breaks it down by line item in terms of, you know, hey, this is your warehousing cost, this is your pick and pack fee, this is, you know, what it's going to cost to ship your product from San Diego to, you know, New York or whatever it may be. So I think too, like from what I've seen in the e-commerce world, you know, ShipBob is definitely a beast and one of the top players in the 3PL space. But sometimes I, from an operator standpoint, question like their pricing model. I'm not quite sure if they still do this like kind of one price model. Okay, they do. Yeah, because I don't know. To me, I like to see line item by line item, you know, hey, this is what everything's costing, right? And I'm just curious, I mean, what do you think their margin is? Have you seen any numbers around like what ShipBob's margins are?
I haven't. I would assume that, you know, they're probably around 10% would be a very healthy kind of 3PL EBITDA number. Obviously, you can go higher or lower, but I agree with you. I think for more sophisticated operators, you really want to be able to see all of the detail. You want to know what the dim charge was. You want to know what different aspects of the fulfillment that were driving inefficiencies so that you could go back and change things and improve it. You know, to be fair to ShipBob, there's a lot to like there. I think that typically they are brand's first 3PL, partly because they're so good at SEO, but also because they do make it easy. And so I think that this all-in-one pricing is something that's helpful for very, very small brands, people who are just trying to get started, because that transparency could really mean the difference.
Yeah, I agree. But I think too, when it comes to that customer segment, I mean, working with small e-commerce brands is like the hardest segment to work with, right? You know, compared to if you look at like, you know, a much bigger fulfillment center, a lot of times they want to work with some, you know, more mature e-commerce brands because, you know, everyone knows those small e-commerce brands, you know, they do have high churn. Some of them make it and grow tremendously and grow with their 3PL. But at that scale too, you know, when you're doing tens of millions in revenue, are you really going to want to have just, you know, one line item, or are you going to want to have each 3PL cost kind of broken out item by item? So I think it's interesting. I mean, they're definitely growing. I mean, I'm pretty sure they're doing like, was it 300 million in revenue or at least 200, something around that?
I think it was closer to 500. They just struck a really good deal with TikTok Shop to be kind of their preferred fulfillment partner. I think what you talked about, though, of being really small brands and who they're working with, that only gets exacerbated by being the TikTok Shop kind of go-to person. You know, they advertise they have about 7,000 brands that are part of ShipBob, and that's an amazing number. But I also talked to some folks that were close there a few weeks back, and they mentioned that they really only retain customers for a little over a year. And so that can be a very difficult kind of thing where you have a high amount of churn, you have these small guys that are coming through. And then really to grow their business and to grow their valuation, they're going to have to reposition themselves to not being a really small, you know, not being a 3PL for really small brands, but to be really big brands, and I think they're going to have to be more complicated. You know, as far as the $4 billion valuation goes, I think there's a path that they could do that, but it would basically be if they were to split up their company into three parts. I would split it up between the fulfillment operation, a real estate play, because they do own their own warehouses in the U.S., and then their technology. I would split off the technology and allow other investors or other companies to bid on that appropriately. But it's just difficult when you have all three of those things wrapped into one, because you're going to attract different investors that are almost going to discount the fact that these things are not pure play, as opposed to giving the benefit of it all being together.
That's a really good point. But I mean, I feel like with their partnership with TikTok Shops, they're kind of heading in the opposite direction of attracting big brands. And, you know, for anyone that knows TikTok Shops, I mean, you're talking about huge spikes in short periods of time that go from shipping, you know, 10,000 orders in a 2-day period to back down to a few orders a day, right? And I think diving into what I saw the past week was really just one article around how there are now founders that are like creating AI videos across TikTok and becoming affiliates for TikTok Shops. And there was like one creator in this article that's just using like AI videos and AI copy to literally make like $200,000 a month as an affiliate to random products on TikTok Shops. And it's crazy, because I think a lot of times most people in the e-commerce world right now really focus on the convergence of creators and commerce. And, you know, are creators going to be like AI in the future? It's something that is really interesting to me, and something that, you know, kind of seems to have come to fruition in some sense right now on TikTok Shops. And I also think too, a lot of, you know, creators are using, you know, their voice and image to, you know, create more content using AI. And so I think in the future, you're going to be able to like work with like a creator's persona without actually having to go like film or do like a photo shoot with them. And it will just be like, you know, their AI avatar in some sense that actually, you know, looks like them. And, you know, you pay them like a commission or a partnership agreement or something of that nature to use their AI.
That is amazing and scary at the same time. At what point are we going to get an AI bot to launch like 10 podcasts?
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing too. You know, I've seen already, you know, podcasts driven by AI that are replicating, you know, Joe Rogan's voice or someone, you know, some big podcaster. It's pretty eye-opening to see. And I think this is kind of just the literally first inning of AI, and it's progressing so fast.
You know, that reminds me of something that I had heard that was kind of a tinfoil hat sort of scam that people were talking about a year ago when AI was first coming to fruition, but you're starting to see more and more of. And that is basically scammers mimicking the voice of your child or your parent and calling you and saying, hey, I lost my phone. I need to give my social security number to the police. Like, I got arrested, whatever. Can you please send it to me? And, you know, if someone's able to mimic and sound exactly like your loved one, and is able to kind of push this thing, that's just a very scary world that, you know, you almost have to come up with a safe word or a code word whenever you're talking to a loved one to make sure it's really them on the other line.
Yeah. It is scary. It is scary. And it's progressing so fast when it comes to that industry. It's pretty crazy to see. Well, I think let's dive into Blenders Eyewear. I mean, this is one of the most incredible stories out of California. Chase Fisher, the founder, started in 2011, went to San Diego State University. And really kind of that spark for this brand is, you know, as a kind of recent college graduate, Chase would like to go out and have fun. And one night at Flux Nightclub, you know, he basically had gone and bought these neon sunglasses just at Target. And for whatever reason, people at that nightclub like connected and really liked those sunglasses. And he realized that, you know, most people, when you go on the beach in San Diego, they're just wearing like Ray-Bans or Oakleys. And I think there's like two main problems with that is, number one, those sunglasses are in general pretty expensive. And number two, everyone loses their sunglasses. I mean, every summer I'm losing like three sunglasses, you know? And so I think the spark for Blenders was really that he wanted to create like a eye-catching, you know, poppy brand that stuck out, that wasn't so expensive, right? And so, you know, when Blenders launched, their sunglasses were like almost a third of what like a nice pair of Ray-Bans or Oakley would cost. And, you know, he started really with grassroots marketing. I mean, you know, they started with just a few hundred bucks and kind of grew from a grassroots approach rather than, you know, raising a bunch of capital. And so I guess my first question to you, Aaron, is, you know, it is pretty incredible to see someone start with just a few hundred dollars and have just a, you know, huge exit like Blenders did. Do you think like, is that like can brands still do that today? Right? Because so many brands that we talk about, whether it be like Allbirds or Away Luggage, like they start by raising so much money, and Blenders, you know, really didn't raise like any money.
You know, it's a great question. I think that the days of VCs writing you a $5 million check to go figure it out, those are probably behind us or on pause at the very least for the next couple of years. What I think that's unique about Blenders is just the bootstrapping mentality. I mean, as you're talking about, to get their initial fund, or I guess the initial funds that they needed, he actually went to his roommate who offered him $2,000 as a loan. He offered to pay him back $2,500 in 6 months. He took that $2,000, he bought a website, bought the trademark, and then purchased as much inventory as he could for that $2,000, which I think was like 300 pairs, if I remember correctly. And as you're saying, he was kind of walking up and down the beach, just trying to sell these things for $20 a pop. And, you know, I think that there's like lessons there that we can look at where, yes, people can still start small businesses and they're going to approach like that. But as you'll see with this, I mean, Chase did a fantastic job of just taking the wins where he could without needing to, you know, have a whole lot of money to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think their timing was incredible. I mean, they really were fueled by Instagram. And so when they launched, you know, Instagram was still really young. There was, you know, very few brands creating like catchy, engaging content. And Instagram was really a huge catalyst to Blenders' growth. And for those that are wondering how the name Blenders came to be, it was actually because Chase lived on a street in Pacific Beach in San Diego named Horton Blend Street. And he would always call it, you know, come to blend. And then they just, you know, said, hey, let's name our brand Blenders. So I think it's kind of a unique way to derive and you know, discover a name, because so many people kind of get caught up in how do I name my brand, which I think is a really unique aspect to the story. But yeah, I mean, I think their timing in terms of, you know, riding that early wave of Instagram was huge for them. And, you know, they didn't like pop off right off the bat, right? Like 2012, they do $8,000 in revenue. 2013, they do $100,000. And 2015, they break the $1 million mark. And so, you know, most of that is fueled by social media. And they didn't really expand to retail till much later on, like you know, pretty much post acquisition when they started opening up some of their own stores. But I think it's just like so interesting to see how Blenders really had a grassroots approach in terms of engaging its community and growing through social media. And I wonder too, like, is there opportunities to do that today on TikTok Shop?
Absolutely. I think you have to be on TikTok Shop today. It seems to be the next forum that people are looking at. But I would step back and look at it in a little bit more of a macro sense. You know, Blenders was started in 2011, 2012. They didn't really start to play with Instagram until 2013. Again, Instagram was founded, I think, 2010. They've been acquired by Facebook in 2012, 2013 timeframe. So this is still very, very early days. And the part that was interesting to me was it wasn't like, looking back in retrospect, it's like, of course, if you build a following on Instagram, that's going to translate well into what's there. But at the time, that wasn't well known. That wasn't a foregone conclusion. People didn't have the perspective that I need to build a following on Instagram. And there weren't any sunglass companies doing this. There really weren't ads on Instagram. It was something where Chase chose a vertical. He chose a social media platform and he doubled down on it. And he started to amass, I think, a couple hundred thousand followers for Blenders. People were sharing, people were showing what they were doing. And so it's really interesting where you think about today. I think if you were to look in 2024, people would kind of come to the conclusion that, yeah, TikTok is probably a place you need to be. That's going to be one of the winners for where an audience is. But it's almost as if he made this decision in 2019, 2020 to be on TikTok comparative to Instagram. And so I've been thinking a lot this weekend about, you know, what's the next thing that's out there, and what, you know, where should be people be putting their efforts in? It's really hard to tell.
Yeah, I agree. And I think too, like, they had an organic approach and they really kind of used out of the box thinking to drive growth of their email list and, you know, SMS list. Like, I know they used to give away trips to Hawaii, which was super cool. So they, you know, say on their email pop-up, enter to win a Blenders, you know, trip, all-in paid trip to Hawaii. And I think that's cool because most people on their pop-up, they're just offering, like, you know, some discount or whatever it may be. And so I think that's a really cool approach that they took to further engage their community rather than just, you know, discounting their product with their pop-up, which is, you know, I think an amazing way to engage a community and grow a brand.
Yeah, at first glance, it seems like it's ridiculous, but if you could spend $5,000 or $6,000 and gain, you know, 10,000 email signatures, you would take that CAC all day, every day.
Totally. And I think that's, like, I think one of the kind of genius sides of Chase and his team in terms of taking a different approach to, you know, grow their community and grow their lists. And I think even to this day, it's, you know, come to light with their influencer and creator marketing strategy and partnerships. I mean, it really is just pretty incredible what they've done.
Yeah. And I think going back to your comments here on their social media presence and strategy, one of the things that really stuck out to me was that they made a really big effort early on to engage with their customers. And so he was regularly messaging people. He was regularly interacting with them. And it was less of a, hey, here's my product. We've got a new style that just dropped. Here's a discount code. It was really that piece of trying to connect with people. And then, you know, similar to that with how he started, he was walking up and down the beach and he was selling things. He was trying to push things back and forth that way. And so there was a lot of just really good customer feedback that he was getting from a day-to-day perspective, whether it be walking the beach and figuring out what styles were performing better than others, or interacting with folks on Instagram and saying, hey, you know, which ones do you like more? Show me, you know, where you were with these sorts of things. And so I just think that there's a principle here around building your audience, yes, but also engaging with your audience in more of an authentic way.
Yeah, totally. I think that's, like, one of the key parts of how they've grown their brand. And I mean, the revenue growth between, like, call it 2015 and when they were acquired in 2019 is tremendous. I mean, I think that was fueled by a multitude of aspects, like their, you know, influencer marketing partnerships, their giveaways, everything, you know, they did across social to grow their brand. But I think too, they've really had, like, a community driven approach. I mean, do you want to kind of touch on that growth from 2015 to 2019? I think it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. So just to kind of walk through the whole waterfall. So $8,000 in 2012, yay. $100,000 in 2013. That's amazing growth. $1 million in 2015. Then 2016, it seems like they were trying to figure some stuff out because they only grew by 30%. So 1.3 million. But then they definitely figured some stuff out. And when they were acquired in 2019, they had revenue about $40 million. And so a pretty massive explosion, which obviously coalesces around kind of the heyday of Instagram and Facebook marketing. And this is kind of pre-TikTok, but really one of those rocket ships from that era.
Yeah. And I think too, like, the acquisition was amazing, right? Like, at the time of acquisition, Chase owned 100% of the brand. They sold to Safilo Group, which is a big, you know, eyewear and sunglass conglomerate. And Chase sold 70% of the brand for $63 million. That's what he pocketed, right? And I think there was also a incentive for him to continue to grow it. You know, Chase is still running the company. He's still got that same, you know, powerhouse team in place. But I mean, that's just an incredible story that you often don't hear about in today's, you know, e-commerce market, in terms of a founder bootstrapping this brand over a, you know, basically 7-8 year period and pocketing, you know, $63 million. That's incredible. And so I think it goes to show just how innovative and how timely they were with social media. I think, you know, they really grew a strong following and they really were engaging with their community. And I think a lot of people think like, oh, like how did, you know, blenders really work if their price point is like $40 to $60? You know, it's so hard to spend on customer acquisition and have a profitable CAC at that price point, especially on sunglasses. But I think they focused on two things. Number one, bundles. So most people that are buying, you know, on Blender's website, they, you know, are buying multiple sunglasses at a time. And they incentivize you in their checkout flow to bundle more sunglasses at once to increase your AOV. And number two, I would say is sunglasses in general have like a pretty high repeat purchase rate because so many people, you know, lose or break their sunglasses. And so I think especially at that price point, Blenders, you know, does have a high repeat purchase rate, which is obviously amazing for their company.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think, other than looking to take some money off the table, what do you think they were, you know, Chase ultimately decided to sell 70% of the business?
You know, I think it was probably just the expertise that Cefilo brings to the table in terms of, you know, beefing up their supply chain, in terms of, you know, adding more distribution channels, in terms of, you know, having more capital to test and iterate on their product and work with, you know, larger influencers and creators that we'll talk about shortly with what they've done with Coach Prime. But I think those are kind of the three main reasons in terms of, you know, beefing up their supply chain, enabling more distribution, and being able to, you know, innovate and take more risks when it comes to these partnerships.
That's great. Probably add in some international distribution as well. I think Blenders was primarily a North American business. And now that you've got connections all over the world, that probably just makes it better. But I'd love to talk about Coach Prime. It's kind of interesting because if you look at the articles that were posted or written about Blenders, there was a lot up until the acquisition and then not very much. And then just in the last 6 months, there's been quite a bit that's happened with Coach Prime.
Yeah, I mean, this story is incredible, right? With what they've done with Coach Prime. And I think part of the reason why there wasn't like a ton of, you know, commentary around Blenders in the e-commerce world is because from when they got acquired to this, you know, major Coach Prime partnership, there wasn't too much action there. I mean, they had opened up a few stores, but I don't think Blenders was necessarily growing at the tick that Cefilo thought it would grow post-acquisition. And, you know, I follow Chase on Instagram and I've seen him, you know, kind of talk about how proud he was when, you know, he got this Coach Prime deal when it really, you know, popped off. And what's crazy too is if you look at, you know, the history of Blenders and Coach Prime, you know, even before Coach Prime was at Colorado State University as the head coach of their football team, you know, Chase's dad had encouraged him to approach him when he was at Jackson State because, you know, a lot of teams do deals with shoe companies, obviously, you know, Nike, Adidas, you name it. But, you know, very few do sunglass deals. And I think, you know, when it comes to timing, you look at what's happened with, you know, college athletes now being able to make income from brand partnerships and brand deals like this. You know, the timing for this was just spot on because, you know, flashback 5 years ago, you couldn't pay, you know, a college athlete to wear your sunglasses.
That's true. But they've been one of the early guys with NIL as well, kind of looking at some of these deals. And I think what's interesting with this Coach Prime deal is that they knew that once he moved to Colorado, all eyeballs were going to be on him. And that was definitely true. As a college football fan, I was really tuned in to the Colorado games until they started losing a bunch. But I think the rest of the nation was there as well. But they had already planned on this collaboration. And when they were having their rivalry game with the Colorado State coach, Jay Norvell, he took a shot at Coach Sanders. And, you know, in retrospect, you wonder if maybe, you know, Jay Norvell should have gotten a piece of this action because he really started the marketing genie that went off of this. But he said that to the media, says, when I talk to grownups, I take my hat and my glasses off. And he said, that's what my mother taught me. And Coach Prime, whether he was just really succinct at managing media expectations or this was an all natural thing, he took it personally. And so he immediately rallied his team behind this slogan, "It's personal," getting ready for that game. And he actually ended up trademarking that as well. But they had planned on announcing the partnership, I think it was like September 20th, and then pulling it forward to September 15th, when he gifted all of his players a pair of those Okinic shades. And so it was just this kind of really amazing timing moment where maybe Coach Prime knew that this was going to be announced for the next week, and so he was looking for an excuse to bring this up, or maybe it was just luck of the draw. But Blenders has amazing timing, just in general.
Yeah, I think they capitalized on the moment, right? They had this deal in the works, and then when that comment was made by, you know, Jay Norrell, the CSU coach, you know, Coach Prime and Chase were probably like, hey, you know, we need to launch this now. And it just took off like crazy. So Coach Prime, you know, gave every player a pair of his signature shades. He priced the sunglasses at $67, his birth year. And, you know, it was just pretty incredible to see the rally. And I think the media attention they got was like insane. I mean, I remember, you know, number one, Coach Prime is just such a media personality to begin with. But number two, I mean, I remember watching, you know, CU Game Day, and they had The Rock on ESPN, and he's wearing the shades too. You know, it was just incredible to see the reach that Blenders and Coach Prime got, you know, around this, you know, sunglass partnership. And I mean, you talk about supply chain planning and forecasting. You know, Blenders had forecasted and planned to sell 16,000 pairs of the shades. And the company, you know, Blenders, they amassed well over that. I mean, over 70,000 orders at this point, probably well over 100,000 orders. And they ended up doing $1.2 million in sales the first day upon launch, and $4.5 million in a little over a week. So you can do the math of $4.5 million divided by 67 in a week. I mean, that's just insane. What do you think their supply chain looked like that week? Like, was their team just pulling their hair out, or what was going on behind the scenes?
I think there was a lot of excitement, but, you know, a lot of tension at the same time. I'm sure there were quite a few conversations and calls to China saying, hey, yeah, we're going to need you to keep those people a little bit longer and make a little bit more. But you love these viral moments. And so they're really rare and really special. And when you're on a supply chain team and you get a chance to be the hero and deliver these things, even if it might be a day or two late, those are just stories you take with you.
Totally, totally. I mean, I think it's just incredible to see how, you know, Coach Prime was open to capitalizing on this moment. I'm curious, I mean, there's not too many stories in regards to like what the actual back end deal looks like. Do you think Coach Prime got like a flat profit share, a flat, you know, X amount of dollars per sunglasses? Like, what do you think that deal actually looks like between Coach Prime and Blenders?
I'm sure there's a rev share component. You look at, you know, they used shoe deals as their model for doing this. And whether it's the LeBron shoes or the Air Jordans or the Kobe's, there's always a rev share element to that. And so I'm sure that Coach Prime probably had, if I had to guess, it's probably anywhere from 10 to 25% rev share with that. And, you know, he probably did very well.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I have seen the cars that him and his team drive on campus. I know they've been reported. And I think it's, you know, partially due to Blenders in terms of the revenue and growth that they drove. I mean, it's just an incredible story for Blenders. I mean, not only just to be acquired, you know, but then also have that acquisition and have this story. I think, you know, what Chase and the Blenders team has done with this is just incredible. And I am sure there'll be other big creator, you know, celebrity partnerships in the future, given this, you know, growth that they've had through the Coach Prime deal that they did. I'm curious, because I know we've done a lot of research on their supply chain. Walk us through, you know, what kind of their factory base looks like, who was actually, you know, manufacturing 100,000 sunglasses in a week. I mean, who could pull that off for them?
Yeah, so they're sourcing exclusively from China. And their sourcing strategy seems a little bit interesting, where they're rotating back and forth from different providers. It seems that they will play them off of one another. I'm going to let you pronounce these names, because you'll pronounce them correctly. But going back, it's interesting to see how in 2015, 2016, they would have maybe one or two shipments a year. And now they're doing one or two shipments a quarter. And this just gives you a sense of where they are. And I can't remember, we mentioned this, but they were $40 million and they were acquired in 2019. In 2021, so 2 years in, they were $85 million. I can only imagine what they are now. So probably over 100, I would imagine, just with the Dion deal. But certainly grown pretty quickly.
Oh, it's incredible. And I mean, for those that want to know their factory base, you know, we did some research in terms of, you know, looking up their import records and trying to understand their factory base. So it looks like they work with four main suppliers, Taizhou Cremillo Glasses starting in April 2022, Wenzhou Success Group starting in January 2023, Direct Vision Supply starting in April 2022, and Xiamen Ubest Eyewear, which looks like they transitioned quite a bit of volume to this supplier. So, I mean, it's incredible to have that factory base. You know, obviously they are not single sourced, which is super important for a brand like this, especially when they're, you know, growing like crazy through a partnership with Coach Prime. I'm curious, I mean, when they're placing that order for that partnership with Coach Prime, do you think they're placing it at one factory? Do you think they're, you know, flexing a few different factories to handle that demand? What do you think that looks like from a supply chain perspective?
Yeah, strategically, it's not a bad idea to have all of your factories qualified to produce a similar type of product. It looks like what they're doing is they are probably sourcing out, and then they've got one factory doing the Coach Prime deal. Just looking through the website, it looked, there were some very similar looking sunglasses on a couple of these that looked to be kind of where they were getting it from.
Yeah, makes sense. And then in terms of their fulfillment, I mean, what does that look like, right? Because on one hand, you have a brand that's growing like crazy that also has a bit of a retail presence. And then on the other hand, you also need a fulfillment center that can flex when, you know, all of a sudden you do 100,000 orders in a week unexpectedly. You know, you need the right back-end fulfillment partner to handle that. What does that fulfillment base look like?
Yeah, so really interesting. There's some unique things that popped up when we were looking at the supply chain. So it appears that they partnered initially with Saddle Creek Logistics, at least for the first few years, but have since 2022 shifted over to PFS. And PFS is an interesting provider, originally from Texas, had about 11 locations, but they were acquired by GXO in 2023, in October. We were talking about ShipBob earlier for $4 billion. PFS was acquired for $181 million, so a little bit different there. But GXO, good company, trying to do their roll-up strategy here. But their main interest in the PFS deal was they wanted to get into these higher growth verticals like cosmetics and fashion. And I think part of this was a bit of a reaction because in 2021, 2022, Ryder, who's one of their biggest competitors in the space, acquired Whiplash for $480 million some dollars. And so I kind of bring all this up because one, there's some interesting commentary just around what's going on as far as consolidations in the fulfillment ecosystem. But also whenever there is a change in ownership at a fulfillment center, it typically, it's one that you really have to pay attention to. I'm not saying that things are slowing down or not doing well, but it's there's certainly a change there. And so I would be curious to know how Blenders feels about the PFS relationship since the acquisition, since it really just happened less than 6 months ago. And, you know, I've heard stories of new ownership coming in, the operators, the folks that knew your business, who knew what was going on, they leave, they get their payday. And then you kind of have new folks that are coming in, new ideas, they want to change things. And so I personally prefer not to go to a fulfillment center if I can help it, if there's been a change in ownership in the last 12 to 18 months. Obviously they're here, and so it's a big deal to move a 3PL. But I'm sure that the GXO team is paying special attention to make sure they're keeping a company like Blenders happy.
Totally. I mean, especially with that kind of pass-through relationship with the Safilo Group, which is, you know, a huge eyewear conglomerate, it's got to be a super important relationship for GXO. So I'm sure they're keeping a close eye on them, unlike, if you're a small brand at ShipBob, it's a lot different here, that's for sure. And especially, you know, I think you need this scaled up fulfillment center that has, you know, 11 fulfillment locations across the country in order to handle that demand. I mean, I'm estimating, you know, I don't have any, you know, insight information here in regards to how Blenders manages its inventory at these fulfillment centers, but I would estimate that they, you know, utilize at least two, maybe even three fulfillment centers for, you know, East Coast and West Coast, just to, you know, lower their shipping costs to their customers, because, you know, most of their volume is still through their website directly.
Yeah, interesting enough, when I can tell that they're just using a single fulfillment center in Memphis, which you put it Memphis because of FedEx. And so if you're going to have a single location, Memphis is a good location. So is Cincinnati or Louisville, just with kind of where the major hubs are. And so, you know, they're probably looking at something where they are leveraging the next day or, you know, 2-day network, and then using SurePost for slower deals and things like that.
Makes sense.
I wanted to go back a little bit, Nathan, and pick your thoughts on the factory. So even though they are not single sourcing from a specific factory, they are single sourcing from a particular country. Do you see that there's risk in that, or is there something that you would recommend people look at and keep going?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question. You know, I think obviously there's inherent risks of being single sourced in China, especially right now, given the political climate. And, you know, we've seen changes in tariffs. We've seen big changes in the relationships between America and China over the past, you know, 5 years. But I think, you know, there are other options. So I am a bit surprised they don't have, you know, options in Mexico or, you know, other parts of Southeast Asia. I think Mexico would be a no-brainer for them. I mean, at Sourcify, you know, I know we've done sunglasses in probably 3 or 4 different countries. And so, you know, though China is probably the most efficient way for the most part to produce sunglasses, you know, at this scale, it does make sense to look at options outside of China. So, I mean, you know, if I were the head of supply chain, I would definitely look for a resource and work with a resource in Mexico and possibly somewhere else in Asia as well. But I think especially when they're flexing order volume that quickly, you know, having a resource in Mexico would be amazing from a logistics perspective, just to, you know, get product over. I mean, fortunately, sunglasses are lightweight, and so the air freight is not, you know, crazy expensive. But at the same time, I mean, you know, they would be able to avoid air freight when they have a big spike working with a big creator or celebrity like Coach Prime. That would make a lot of sense to be able to flex some resources in Mexico from that angle.
That makes sense. I think too, you know, you look at other countries that have free trade agreements with the U.S., and even though it may be a little bit more expensive coming out of Mauritius or India directly, once you add in the tariffs, you add in some transit costs, it can be pretty competitive. So it's an interesting piece there, and it'll be interesting to see if the Blenders team decides to add in some geographic diversity there.
Yeah, we'll have to keep a pulse on this. It's a really good question, and yeah, to me, because they have such spikes in orders with these partnerships, you know, it's so hard to forecast when you work with a creator or celebrity like that, that it makes a lot of sense to have something, you know, closer that they could flex more efficiently. I'm curious though. I mean, it looks like, you know, kind of from the surface level of this story, you know, Chase graduates San Diego State University. He sees this gap in the sunglasses market, starts just selling sunglasses where he can, and, you know, meets and partners with creators and influencers and celebrities in the early days of Instagram, and starts growing an incredible following, and then creates giveaways to trips to Hawaii and other places, you know, across the country for his community, and grows his, you know, email and SMS list like incredibly well. And so, you know, I think some people would ask, can you do this today? You know, do you need to raise funding when you start? You know, or is there still that opportunity to, you know, do these giveaways? I mean, what's your opinion on that?
I would answer a couple of different ways. I think, yes, you can start a sunglass company today. Sunglasses existed for a long time before he had his idea, and they were cheap sunglasses. They were very expensive sunglasses. I think that the lesson that I took from his founding story was that he was willing to start very, very small, and he was willing to do the work himself, and he was willing to sacrifice and not necessarily have a payday. I mean, he borrowed $2,000 from his roommate he bought 300 pairs of those sunglasses. He was walking up and down the beach, selling them out of his backpack. And then he would take, you know, the two or three sales that he had that day. So call it $60. And he put that back into the bank and decided to use that. And so I think that there's a big difference between somebody who wants to play startup and someone who really wants to build a business. And I think that the advice or kind of the lesson I would take from this is that you can absolutely do both, right? I always laugh because when I was first starting ISBA, I met this founder who really just had a $20 Starbucks latte, and he had a WeWork membership, and he was just kind of hanging out, and he was concepting, he was ideating, and he was trying to figure out like, oh yeah, you know, I'm gonna make $1 billion one day. I'm just trying to work on this idea. And he may be really successful today, but it kind of struck me as like, what are you doing, right? You're spending money, you're doing these things. You don't really have things there, but you get to call yourself an entrepreneur, you can call yourself a founder, way to go. And then met other people who are just very scrappy, and scrappy in the sense of, hey, I really want to see if there's something here. I don't need a salary on this. You know, Chase talks about how it was probably a year or so before he took even $1,000 out of the business for himself because he wanted to see if there was something here. And building a business is all about creating these repeatable processes and these repeatable habits with customers so that they can come back. And so if you're focused on that versus trying to play startup, I think that there's enormous lessons here you can learn from Blenders.
I agree. It really goes to show being scrappy in the early days goes a long way. I mean, it reminds me of the Brewmate story and Dylan Jacob. I mean, they scaled to $20 million a year in revenue with no employees. Like, you don't hear about stories like that in the e-commerce world today, and it's really inspiring. I mean, I really admire the Blenders team for you know, making the most of what they have and being, you know, growth-minded in an organic way. I think it's incredible. I want to talk about the timing too, right? Because, you know, there definitely is some sense of like right time, right place, whether that be with Coach Prime, whether that be with, you know, timing their growth on Instagram. I mean, like how much of the story would you attribute to luck and timing versus just, you know, really grinding it out and being, you know, in the weeds? I mean, it seems like it's a bit of a balance of both, but I mean, a lot of this to me too is timing. I think, you know, picking the right platform to grow an audience on, you know, working with the right influencers and celebrities on these partnerships. It's to me a balance of both. And it's just remarkable to see how they've executed.
Yeah, it is so hard to start a business, and it is so hard to keep going with a business. And so I think that you have to have luck in order to be successful. But I'm also one of these folks that thinks that hard work helps create your own luck. And so, you know, in the research, we saw that Chase had a couple of times where he was just expecting to buy these sunglasses and have the same sort of experience that he had in the nightclub where people would just, you know, pay him a bunch of money and he'd have a big stack of bills and go back to it. But that didn't happen for him. And there were times where he thought he was going to quit. And he just felt that, you know, the only time that I'm a failure is if I actually quit. And, you know, so his first year, he did $8,000 in revenue. I don't know how many founders would not have a job and would be willing to continue with $8,000 in revenue. And so you absolutely have to get lucky. But you also have to work incredibly hard to create the circumstances so that you can become lucky.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, a little bit of insight, you know, from my side, having lived in San Diego for 9 years and, you know, meeting Chase and really being a part of that community in person and seeing just the growth of Blenders in San Diego happen firsthand. I mean, Chase as well was surrounded by his best friends, Griffin Thal and Paul Goodman from Pura Vida Bracelets. I mean, everyone in San Diego kind of knows these guys in the e-commerce community really, you know, share notes and hang out together. And Pura Vida had a massive exit as well, actually around the same time as Blenders. But, you know, I think it just kind of goes to show as well, Chase was surrounding himself with other founders that were going after it, scaling their brand, and really doing so in an efficient manner as well, because Pura Vida didn't raise any capital either before they sold. So, you know, I think it goes to show how important the people you surround yourself are, because, you know, I'm sure they were both sharing notes in terms of how they've grown. And Pura Vida as well was a low price product. And you're talking about these bracelets that are selling for, you know, $5 to $10, $20. And Pura Vida was able to do so in a profitable manner. And so I think there's a lot of similarities in terms of how those brands grew and how they approached their business. And I think a community is a huge aspect to their success. And it's really just incredible to see, you know, this coming out of San Diego. It's just been an amazing story to see firsthand.
Yeah, and that, like, that is exactly one of the things I'm talking about when I talk about how you have to be putting in the effort to create your own luck. Chase and the founders of Pura Vida could have decided that, you know what, the most important thing for me is the business. I'm going to go heads down. I'm not going to interact with anybody else. I don't want to share what's going on. I am just going to focus on this 24 hours a day. And it takes effort to build relationships. It takes effort to be helpful to people. It takes effort to network and to see people over. It's not a, hey, I went to one event and talked to people and now they're going to give me their whole playbook. You have to really build these relationships and get to know people. And that is a long game, but it's probably the most important thing that any founder could do is just try to be genuinely helpful to other people and to just be a good person and make friends to some extent.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think too, you know, one thing that I noticed that's interesting as we did our research was, you know, when they were starting out, you know, their price point was like $20, $30, it then grew to like, you know, $50, $60, $70. Now they're, you know, selling some sunglasses for $100, over $100. You know, what do you think that tells us about where AOV needs to be at from an e-commerce perspective in this market? I mean, do you think they were kind of pushed to raise their pricing post-acquisition? What do you think that looks like? I'm just kind of curious because it's interesting to see, you know, many brands in today's world can't just be reliant on, you know, Meta, Facebook ads or Instagram ads, right? They've got to, you know, really be reliant on their community, I think, in today's world. And so I'm curious, you know, what do you think was the main kind of thesis and reasoning for increasing their price points?
I think it was probably out of necessity. Keep in mind that the first sales channel was Chase's backpack, right? So all he needed, he was his own warehouse, right? And he was his own sales team. So he didn't have to pay any of that. The CAC was zero. It was just his time. And so, you know, he was probably making $10, $12 per pair of sunglasses, maybe a lot more, for each of these sales that he had. And then as he decided and said, well, I probably can't scale myself walking around the beaches in San Diego, there's probably not a huge market. I need to be online. Well, you start to look at this and say, okay, if I have a $15 CAC, that's suddenly costs I need to bake in there. So in order to keep my margins where they need to be, I need to start increasing my prices. And so as they started to gain more traction, and you know, Coach Prime is those Prime sunglasses are a good example because they started out at $67 and now they're well over $100. And that's partially because the demand is so high. And so you use price to affect the demand. And so I think it was a very natural kind of conversation evolution where he just looked at this and said, hey, you know, I need to charge more because I now have these costs I didn't have before. And so that's how the pricing changes.
I agree. This has been a fascinating story. I mean, I really admire Blenders. I admire Chase Fisher and his whole team. I mean, it's just been incredible to see their growth. Is there any, you know, parting notes or question that you have that you think we should touch on before we leave this episode of e-commerce on tap?
You know, I mentioned this a little bit earlier. I was kind of thinking about how does somebody spot the next trend or the next thing to be on? And there's no formula, right? There's nothing out there. But what I found is that it's going to take effort no matter what. And you're going to kiss a couple of frogs before you find your prince. And you're going to try things like Threads. You're going to try things like Clubhouse. And I think the key thing here that I learned from this deep dive was that you have to be willing to try. You have to be willing to put full effort into it for a period of time. And then you can, you know, hopefully it pays off that way. And so if you think about what is difficult for people to do today, well, there's quite a few things, right? Making content is hard. But you know, you think about 5 or 10 years ago, it was very difficult for people to have a podcast. And so now that there are lots of tools that make it easier, there are more people that are going to do that. And so if you're trying to be like Blenders, you're saying, all right, how do I go to where there's nobody else? Because there were no other sunglasses on Instagram. And how do I start building a following? It's about doing those things that there isn't a clear path. It is a difficult thing. You just have to try it. And hopefully you get lucky with, you know, every one or 20 that you try.
I agree. You got to take swings at bat, and one of them you're going to hit out of the park, right? I think that's the key of, you know, entrepreneurship and founding one of these brands, and you know, getting the right timing is incredible, and having the right community. So just been an incredible story to dive into Blenders Eyewear. Thank you everyone for tuning in to this episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Source Fine ISBA. Please subscribe, like, share, leave a comment. We really appreciate it. And thank you again for tuning in.